So good morning. I think we'll go ahead and get started. So those of you who are around on the sides, if you'd like to come up, there are still a few more seats at the table. So feel free to come and take a seat and be a little closer to the discussion. My name is Catherine Bliss, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to CSIS this morning. As many of you know, today is the celebration of Earth Day here, and since this year's celebration marks the launch of the new Green Generation campaign, I am especially honored to welcome you to a presentation on climate change and human health by Dr. Maria Neira, Director of the World Health Organization's Public Health and the Environment Department. Dr. Neira's topic is particularly timely for several reasons. As you recall, in 2007, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change found that the effects of temperature increases on some aspects of human health were already being observed. It listed malnutrition, disease and injury due to extreme weather events, a higher burden of diarrheal disease, an increase in the frequency of cardiorespiratory diseases, and altered distribution of some infectious disease vectors to be likely effects. In 2008, WHO Director General Margaret Chan designated the theme of World Health Day to be protecting human health from climate change in order to raise public awareness of the challenges. Then, in May of last year, the World Health Assembly unanimously approved a resolution related to health and climate change. And in the resolution, member countries requested the WHO undertake at least four activities to continue to draw the attention to the attention of the public and policymakers the serious risk of climate change to global health, as well as to the achievement of the health-related Millennium Development Goals, to engage the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change Nairobi World Program on impacts, vulnerability, and adaptation to climate change, and to ensure its relevance to the health sector, to work with member states and UN agencies to enhance capacity to assess risk from climate change to human health and to implement effective response measures, and to develop a work plan for scaling up WHO's technical support to member states for assessing and addressing the implications of climate change for health and health systems. Over the past year, the World Health Organization Secretariat has been developing this work plan, which it will present to the WHO member states at the 2009 World Health Assembly next month. Dr. Neira has been at the forefront of that effort and is here to share details of the plan, as well as WHO's larger strategy on protecting human health from climate change with us. And I would say that given the Environmental Protection Agency's issuing last week of a proposed finding that greenhouse gas pollution threatens the health and welfare of the American public, and this was in response to the Supreme Court directive from a couple of years ago, the WHO's work plan and proposed activities will be of particular interest today. I know you all have copies of Dr. Neira's impressive biography, but let me just say a few words before turning the microphone to her. A physician by training, Dr. Neira has held her current position as Director of the Department of Public Health and the Environment at the World Health Organization in Geneva since 2005. Prior to that, she served as President of the Spanish Food Agency and Vice Minister of Health in Spain. And she served previously at the World Health Organization in a variety of capacities and has considerable international experience working in Mozambique and Rwanda, as well as El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Honduras. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Neira.
Thank you very much, Catherine, and I have to say that I appreciate very much the way you pronounce my name. I'm sure you speak Spanish because your pronunciation is very, very good.
I come from the Americans program
here. You see? Even when you pronounce it Nicaragua and El Salvador, you did it in a very nice way, so thank you for that. My name was pronounced in a perfect way. Thank you very much. I'm extremely pleased to be here with you today. It's the Earth Day, and hopefully, next year, the celebration of the Earth Day will be something like greening the planet, good for your health, or something like that, or your planet, your health. I think it will be a fantastic theme for the celebration next year. So if you have any influence, and I'm sure you have a lot of influence in these type of things, please pass the message, because we are convinced in WHO, and I'm sure that many other people is convinced as well, that if we can associate the environmental agenda to the health agenda, this will produce an amazing social movement, and people will, I'm sure they will think that health can be a very powerful driving force to further engage in environmental activities and particularly to fight climate change. This was not the introduction to my presentation at all, but I'm sure it's a good way to, since we are on a think tank requesting you to influence agendas, I suppose is part of the presentation of today. I'm very pleased to be here representing WHO. I'm here with some WHO colleagues, and I'm sure that some of them you probably had the opportunity to meet them. And I will make a kind of formal presentation, but obviously it will take just a few minutes, and then I will be ready to answer the questions if this is the policy normally. So let me then go with you. You know, I'm Spanish, so I need to use my hands. Catherine, you will be helping me?
Yes.
Great. Okay, let's go for the first one then. Okay, where we are and what is the state of the global climate change negotiations? You know, I have to say that we are extremely pleased in WHO to hear what's happened here last week with the report by the EPA. We are all very excited and we are all very positive about what this new approach of the new administration is taking on climate change. So we are welcoming you very much to this very interesting and important agenda. And we were all waiting for you for this very formal and now very powerful engagement. So in terms of the negotiations, it's true that, as you know, there will be big negotiations in Copenhagen end of the year. And it's true that there are a lot of, a great deal of discussions and interest, and climate change is definitely in all the political agendas. But I have to say that in terms of commitments, there are still few commitments there. And I hope that we will be able to match the two things, the political engagement, the declarations and discussions, and those will be followed by very strong commitments. Otherwise, we will be fail to achieve those commitments that we have. Certain people are asking themselves, why should we engage in something that will cost us a lot of money and will generate a lot of, negotiations and discussions among the different countries when we will not see the benefits until probably next generation. And this is where I think, again, that health can play a very important role, because if you put on the table health arguments, I am sure that this will help on these negotiations and convincing people that it's not just for the next generation and it's not just to benefit the environment, but the engagement we are taking on climate change will benefit the health of the people right now. So that's why we say that a greater focus on health can help. That's one. You know, we are managing little by little to make sure that people understand that climate change agenda, there is a human face behind. It's not just about the polar bear and it's not just about, you know, glaciers that are melting. It's about our health today and the health of the children, not only or necessarily of the next generations, but even the health of the people today and the health of everybody, developing and developed countries. So we are trying to push that human face on the climate change agenda, and we are very pleased to see that the Secretary General now more and more is using this human face in his presentation and his speeches. As mentioned before by Catherine, our Director General decided that climate change and human health was a top priority for WHO. And therefore, the theme of protecting health from climate change was selected as the theme of the World Health Day last year, and we are still using that material very much. And something very important happened last year at the World Health Assembly. You know, at the World Health Assembly is when we have 193 ministers of health sitting in Geneva and looking at what the critical issues for the health of the people are, and they decided that climate change was definitely one of those critical issues that they needed to approve. And it was absolutely a fantastic experience because they approved the resolution with an unexpected and really without precedent support. It was very positive to see the discussions. Well, it's true that one country was a little bit reluctant, but finally they signed it. And this country that I am referring and I will not nominate is now very positive about the approval of this resolution, so we are very happy about that. This year, in January, at our executive board, we presented a work plan, something very concrete, very action-oriented, very pragmatic. And again, it was approved with a lot of support. The ministers of health, they say, yes, we have a role on climate change. And it's not only because we are concerned about the potential negative impact of climate change on the health of the people, and therefore we need to work on adaptation, but it's as well because we are convinced that we have a role in mitigation. And we can do something about in contributing to the mitigation agenda. So your EPA ruling that CO2 endangers public health and welfare is really something fantastic, and we are all, the World Health Assembly, the health community, we are extremely pleased about this resolution. Well, no doubt climate change is a risk factor for human health. And you know, this is Hippocrates, and the father of medicine. And in fact, he says that already many, many years ago. Probably he didn't say it on the same way we are, with the same words that we are using now, but in fact, he was convinced 400 years before Christ that airs, waters, and places were play an important, and they are a determinant of our health, and therefore the connection with our between climate conditions and our health was very well established. So he was a wise man. Now we are even convinced that he was a visionary. Next one, please. I'm sure you don't want to go into details about that, but weather and climate affects health both directly and indirectly, and some of the health effects that we can expect from the climate change are temperature-related illnesses and deaths, extreme weather-related health effects. Those are the direct consequences of extreme natural disaster, for instance, air pollution-related health effects, water and foodborne diseases, vector-borne and rodent-borne diseases, effects of food and water shortages, and effects of population displacement. And that has been, you know, there is a lot of scientific literature proving this one, and has been now widely accepted. This one. Probably you remember what's happened in Europe in the summer 2003, and I had the certainly not the privilege to be there at the Ministry of Health in Spain when this happened. Believe me, it was something absolutely unexpected. In Spain during the summertime, it's quite hot in certain parts of Spain, and the same for Italy and for France. But this heat wave that we have in during that summer, it was definitely very important, and it caused the death of, we calculate around 70,000 people during that summer, because the services were not properly prepared to take into consideration that all people living alone, for instance, in Paris, were not prepared for that, and the health services were not prepared, and early warning systems were not properly working. This was an example of what the direct health effects can be of climate change. Now, if we look at those effects that are indirect, if you look at the major diseases, what we call in WHO the major killers, I mean, and the undernutrition that kills every year 3.5 million people, or diarrhea that kills around 2 million people every year, or malaria that kills around 1 million every year, the three of them, these three factors, are extremely sensitive to climate conditions. Therefore, those are the indirect effects, and those major diseases are very sensitive to the climate. So we are very worried that can be exacerbated with the temperature changes. Next one, please. Before going into this one, I wanted to mention that in Peru, for instance, we have a study showing that if you increase the temperature by 1 degree, you can expect an increase of 8% on the number of diarrheal admissions of the hospital. So this is a direct link that has been even observed before starting to work on climate change. we knew very well that the increase on the temperature will increase the number of diarrheal admissions at the hospital. So there is a very direct link between the two diseases. Well, climate change is already affecting the health of the people, so it's not nothing that we are just expecting to come, but it's already happening, it's already affecting the health of the people. But unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know, but it's affecting the health of the people in a very different way. If you look at the first cartogram, you will see that this is the wall when you look at the cumulative emissions of greenhouse gases in 2002. So Africa doesn't exist, for instance. You will not see Africa. But if you see at whole WHO estimates of per capita mortality from climate change, Africa becomes a macro continent. So those who were responsible for the emissions of greenhouse gases are certainly not those that will be suffering most of the consequences of climate change. So this is something related to equity, and WHO wants to pay attention to that. Well, the positive part of that, the action part, how WHO is reacting. Well, as I said, we have a role, or we are convinced that we have two roles. On adaptation, we need to prepare the health system to be adapted to the consequences of climate change, but on mitigation as well. And we are convinced that this can be an opportunity, quote unquote, for immediate and local health co-benefits. So, for instance, the health co-benefits, and this is why I was saying at the beginning that health can be a very powerful driving force for this climate change agenda. There will be health benefits generated from mitigation activities. And indoor air pollution is one of those examples. You know that indoor air pollution is still killing every year, and one of the air quality, you know, activist, very strong activist, is here today with us, so I'm sure he will be very pleased. Indoor pollution is killing every year 1.5 million. In general, they are women and children, because those are the ones exposed to the combustion of this solid fuel. And the use of those not very clean, you know, they are using fossil fuels to cook or to heat the water that they are using every day, they are contributing to climate change. First, because they are deforestating, and second, because they is black carbon, and there is a small contribution, but still a contribution to the global warming. So if we go for improved stoves for the household in those countries where they don't have access to clean technologies and clean energies, there will be certainly an improvement or an activity to mitigate climate change, but at the same time, it will be good for health. And this is where we have clearly a very strong interest. And we were very happy to learn that the U.S. Energy Bill and EC support will be now jumping on this and then providing improve stoves to at least the 20 million households around the world. So congratulations on that, because it's a fantastic achievement that we will all help to that. Another way we can generate health co-benefits is on transport. Transport policies and are contributing, and the per capita emissions of CO2 from passenger transport in the, we are selecting 84 cities here. This is how it was in 2003. Those transport policies can generate not only benefits and to the climate change fight, but at the same time they can contribute to stimulate a more active lifestyle, and therefore reducing obesity and chronic and cardiovascular diseases. But at the same time, they can as well reduce the traffic incidents and injuries by passengers. So it's definitely a win-win strategy, and the health co-benefits that will be generated are extremely important for us. Those are certain examples. You are at the top there, Atlanta, Houston. This was in 2003. Probably the picture today is a little bit different, but go ahead, please. Go ahead. Things are changing now, but this was the picture in 2003. Next one, please. Next one. Well, this is from Howie Franklin. I'm sure you all know this picture. And we use it with his permission because we are convinced that although it's a little bit old-fashioned, I'm sure that the feminist movement will be a little bit against this stereotype. Myself, I feel a little bit uncomfortable. But anyway, this is a good example, please, this one, when, you know, the fact that you stimulate a sustainable transport policy and an active lifestyle, you increase physical activity, you contribute to reduce air pollution, you will reduce CO2 emissions, this one. You will increase social capital because people will interact a little bit more socially, and, well, you will decrease depression. She may be a little bit depressed because she's not working, but doesn't matter. I mean. Anyway, next one. And you will decrease injuries, and you will decrease osteoporosis. And, well, there is something quite important. By the way, you will decrease infrastructure cost. So a lot of health co-benefits for a good transport policy, and I'm sure there will be more that we are at the moment. There is a major study now led by UK academia and WHO looking at the health co-benefits from a climate change mitigation agenda. Hopefully we will be able to present those studies in Copenhagen in December. And I'm sure that will be something very positive because this climate change agenda needs some positive incentives as well. Otherwise, it will be very difficult to use the negative arguments to generate movement on that. So a lot of health benefits can be obtained from reducer pollution as a result of actions to reduce greenhouse gases emissions, and may offset a substantial fraction of the mitigation cost. This was on the IPCC report in 2007, the one that was awarded with the Nobel Prize. And cleaner energy decisions can bring major health-dominated benefit-cost ratios, and this is from the US EPA in 1999. Environmental management adaptations are highly cost-beneficial. For example, each $1 invested in clean water and sanitation brings 3 to 34 in benefits for health and well-being. And this is from WHO. Next one. Well, think locally, act globally. Why I'm presenting this? Because, next one, please. Oh, sorry, previous one. Because it's not just the article saying how curbing global warming emissions can improve local public health. It's who wrote this article, and is the mayor of New York. So I think it's extremely important to see that a politician, and he said himself at the General Assembly, in a meeting that he was attending, he says, when we engage on activities to fight climate change, we realize that as a result of that, we were generating a lot of social and health benefits. And I think it's fantastic because we will try to mobilize urban local governance and pass them this data, telling them that when they go for environmental interventions, they can generate a lot of health and social benefits. And I'm sure that this will be very good as a politician for mobilizing social action and generating further engagement. Next one, please. So the global response is that, as mentioned it already, we have now a global health assembly resolution approved, and we have now 193 nations that agree on moving on actions to protect health from climate change. They are very much committed. And the next one, please. The objectives included on this plan of action, the work plan that WHO has approved, are very clear. We will continue to do awareness raising, and I suppose that what we are having here today is part of this commitment. We are trying to raise awareness about that. And making clear, or at least that will be our major objective, that the ultimate justification for action on climate change and the environment is to improve human health and well-being, or at least that will be our objective. We would like to inform policymakers and the public on practical solutions to protect the population from weather-related hazards and to reduce climate change. Obviously, as WHO, we have a mandate and we need to continue to generate evidence. So we will be assessing the health risk from climate change. We will identify the effective interventions. We will measure the health effects of decisions in other sectors and support improved decision-making. And we will evaluate, and obviously we will be looking as well for resources to carry on with this agenda. There is a part of our agenda which is on adaptation. What the climate change community call adaptation, in fact, the public health community used to call it prevention. So for us, adaptation means strengthening the existing health systems. We need to work on mitigation, but we know that some effects will be happening anyway or are already happening, and therefore we need to insist on adaptation and the preparation of the health systems. We need to reinforce our disease surveillance and response capacity. We need to work on early warning systems and then making sure that our infectious diseases prevention strategies are working properly. We need to invest on public health basic interventions, like particularly for those diseases that we were presenting before that are very climate sensitive, like malaria, diarrhea, and undernutrition. So we need to reinforce our capacity on vector control, water and sanitation, vaccination and treatment programs. And clearly we need to scale up our work on managing environmental health determinants. And we know that with good environmental interventions, we can reduce by 25% the global burden of diseases. So this can be a good opportunity for us to engage on the climate change agenda if the adaptation part will allow us to tackle this 25% of the global burden of diseases, which is associated with environmental risk factors. Next one. Conclusions. And I will stop here. We need a greater focus on health protection from climate change. So we need to make sure that everybody understands the linkages between climate change and human health. We need people to understand that there is a human face behind this agenda. We need people to understand that poor population will be more affected than others, and they are very vulnerable, so we need to protect them. We need the health adaptation strategy to climate change, and is mainly for us an opportunity to scale up basic preventive health interventions. We need to shift to sustainable energy production and use present major opportunities for health promotion and protection. There are some clear triple wins that we were talking about already for health, for environment, and for the economy. But there are always as well other policies that can be totally harmful or inefficient that we need to avoid. So we need to work with other sectors to make sure that the decisions that they will be taking, they will generate a lot of benefits for the health of the people and not harm. And we need an improved alignment between health, climate change, and development objectives and planning. For us, this is essential. So we will welcome all of you to join us on our effort to raise awareness, to increase attention to this dramatic problem, and to contribute to generate this social movement that hopefully will be able to do something historical in Copenhagen this year and ensure movement for at least the next 10 years in a very strong way. Thank you very much.
Dr. Nina, thank you for a very thorough and interesting overview of the many different aspects of the strategy and what WHO is trying to accomplish with this. And you've indicated you're open to questions. Are there questions from the audience? I know that I have a number of questions, but I want to give people in the audience an opportunity to raise some of their own. That we have representatives from a number of different government agencies, researchers, people from the advocacy side. So please. Well, I will take the privilege then of the first question. which is the... And if you would need a pen. As you were talking, especially in the last few slides, it occurred to me that there's an important personnel dimension to some of this. And I just wondered if you could say a little bit about the ways in which understanding the links between climate and health is incorporated in public health schools or in medical schools, especially in the regions where this is going to be especially important, and you know the extent to which WHO and other agencies are working to address some of the development of professional capacity around these issues.
I'd like to ask for an update on two things that I'm very happy I didn't pick up on.
You press the microphone when you speak, please.
Usually, I talk loud enough, but wow, that's very impressive.
and please, let me ask you before you pose your question to just say your name and your affiliation.
Absolutely,
please.
I'm Laura Peterson from SAIC, and I was asking. I by the way, thank you very much for a very informative presentation. I couldn't agree with you more that disease surveillance and international sharing of information, because disease doesn't know and respect boundaries, could not be more important. So I'd just like to, if you have a chance, to share a little bit more on how WHO is engaging in sharing of disease surveillance and mitigation approaches. I'd really like to hear about that. Thank you.
Let's take one more, and then we'll ask Dr. Neira to respond. In the back, please.
Hello, my name is Nigel Fields. I'm with the US EPA. Good to see you again. I was wondering about how WHO might be linking up the health measures with ecosystem services and the critical services that ecology provides, be it forests, be it health of wetlands, what have you. And are there things that the federal agencies here in the U.S. can do to provide better data on the connections between climate change, ecosystem services, and human health?
They were not properly addressed on my presentation, so this will allow me to go through. The importance of the medical schools and how to generate a movement where public health officials and academia can join this effort. One of the priorities in our work plan is exactly that, engaging the health sector and how the health sector can contribute to this agenda. In fact, we call it leading by example. And there are several activities that we are trying to put in place in this sense. One is something very attractive that we call greening the health sector. And this is a scoop that I am giving you here because it's not yet totally official. We want to launch a movement in which, the health sector, the healthcare facilities, hospitals will be able to engage on greening their hospital, greening their healthcare facilities. And for that, we are creating a kind of network and looking at the different experiences that are already going on in certain countries or in certain regions or small, for the time being, still small initiatives. But we are convinced that the health sector can play an amazing role because, after all, health sector is one of the most important employers in the world. So if we can generate this green in the health sector movement, I think it will be very powerful. Obviously, WHO is starting with that, so we are now conducting an evaluation of our own carbon footprint. Not an easy one, as you can imagine, and very difficult to put in place certain measures, but we will do it, and hopefully we will generate this movement. At the same time, we are creating a global research network. And we are inviting to this network different schools and public health schools and institutions. And obviously, it's an open group, so we are inviting everybody to join us. And putting in place some initiatives to incorporate into the curricula of certain public health schools issues related to public health. There are good experience going on, but still very ad hoc and only in certain countries. More activities on that. Yes, on raising awareness among the health sector. There will be at the World Health Assembly this year. The health sector will be creating 5 to 10 top messages that the health sector will like to see the Copenhagen negotiators taking on board. And one of those messages is probably related to the fact that we need capacity building and we need to these messages to be included in the public health schools curricula. Next week, there will be a meeting in Istanbul of the public health schools associations, and we will be there as well trying to incorporate this issue of climate change and health into the, at least the raising awareness among the different public health schools in the world. So there are several initiatives, maybe some very much advanced, others just initiating, but the movement is there, and obviously any idea in this sense will be very much welcome. Let me avoid the tobacco one for the time being because it's a difficult one, and go to the disease surveillance and the share of information. As you know, we are not creating special systems for disease surveillance. What we are convinced is that this has to be an opportunity to reinforce the existing surveillance systems. And therefore, we are working very much with our colleagues. Actually, we are in the same group in Geneva with Keiji Fukuda, who is American, by the way, and Mike Ryan group, and all the groups working on epidemic preparedness and response, and making sure that the systems that are already assisted for early warning are reactivate or are, reinforced in any case. We are collaborating with the World Meteorological Organization to make sure that the data that they are generating, and this is a little bit addressing your question as well on the ecosystems data and health, making sure that the data that is generated for meteorological purposes can be used in some cases for early warning for there are some experience in Africa, for instance, for dengue or for malaria that can be very interesting and we are exploring very much. So the data that we are sharing is still very much in the form of communicable diseases prevention and response data. There is not specific data separated from that one. Thank you. Tobacco. I don't know whether my colleagues from WHO want to say something about that. For me, it's a win-win. I mean, I'm not sure I understood very well your question, and I'm not sure I'm prepared to answer that. But it seems to me that, WHO, as you know, is very, very much engaged on our fight against tobacco. So we are, in our report, we were using as well the tobacco as one of the contributors of the... But I'm not sure I can answer your question, so I prefer to stop here. But maybe you, I don't know, some. Do you want to say something, WHO colleagues, on this one? Because I'm not sure I'm...
The only thing I can say about the tobacco is the we, in this region at least, has been we have observed that once you eliminate tobacco or you control tobacco, you create a great awareness at social and personal about air, cleanliness of the environment. So it's something that works towards an environmental conscience of the people and more active, engaging in this. The second is tobacco has been a successful history of public health, engaging, mayors, engaging environmental responsible for regulate closed environment. So demonstrate the possibility of an intersectoral action between health, public health agents, environmental agents, housing agents, workplace agents, all together to eliminate tobacco. So I think it's a very good example how we can succeed. But we still have a long run. So we still have a lot of things to do in this region, at least I'm talking about the Latin American and Caribbean. But we do have a very successful history about understanding the problem, in the social environment and do something together. My name is Luis Galvão. I'm the area manager for sustainable development environmental health here in Pau. I am part of Maria Neira's group. Maria Neira is the global coordinator. We are six regions, so each one have one guto in that region.
I can put you, you can give me your name later on and we can put you in contact with the right people in Geneva to answer that question.
No, actually, I didn't ask a question. I thought it was such an obvious sort of thing, yeah. So I'm very grateful. My understanding is that in Europe and North America, there's been a tremendous success in cutting down on tobacco, particularly in public places and even in private places, but that in some parts of the developing world, tobacco usage is increasing. As their per capita income grows. And the world was seeking for some sort of modality whereby you would be effective on all fronts. So I don't know what the latest reports are on South America, Africa, and Asia. These are the areas that were not having the kind of success that you have in North America and Europe. So I was asking if there was a report. Thank you.
There is a global report that has been recently launched, so we will be very happy to share it with you. And as the people in Africa will say, a luta continua, means we are continuing our fight against tobacco, believe me, very strongly. Thank you.
One thing, this is Jacob Moss with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. You mentioned in passing almost the issue of black carbon emissions from cook stoves and the indoor air pollution that is associated with that. It's a topic, I think, you saw the New York Times front page article on that last week. We now have proposed legislation in the United States Congress that seeks to address this at some level at least. And it's gaining a lot of traction. My fear, if you were to do the map that you did showing where the CO2 emissions come from versus where the health burdens are, if you were to do that for black carbon, it would be the reverse on both the emissions and it would be same for the health effects. That is, the emissions come from the developing world generally, because we control particulate matter in the developed world, and the health effects happen in the developed world. So there's a danger there in promoting it on a climate agenda of it appearing as if the developed world is saying, really, you know, the short-term issue is black carbon in developing countries and cook stoves, and the blame is on you, and that's what the priority should be. And that's wrong, and everyone who knows anything about it knows it's wrong, but politically and optically, that's a real danger. And so I think that the way we need to move forward is very actively to promote it as a win-win, where there's a climate benefit, but the massive public health benefit that would result from that would be immediate and tremendous and accrue in the developing world. So I'm wondering, obviously WHO would be an enormous partner in that kind of message and in carrying that message, not away from CO2, but in terms of adding the health angle on the black carbon piece. And have you given that any thought? Have you woven that into your strategic thinking at all?
Thank you, Jacob. And absolutely, we were reading the New York Times article. Actually, I have it here with me, and I'm sure it will be of interest to the audience. And I was very pleased to see that on the bill that was passed at the House of Representatives, they say public health and environmental benefits. So all the time is focusing on the public health benefits. And this is exactly the angle that we will be taking in WHO, because we are very much aware that this can generate a kind of perception by certain countries that this is a way to divert responsibilities, to pass responsibility to developing countries on the climate change agenda. So we have to be very careful and just to focus on the public health benefits that will be enormous. And subsequently, and eventually might generate benefits to the environment and eventually to the climate change agenda. But I fully agree with you, and this is the angle that WHO will be taking to focus on the public health benefits. We have been fighting for the indoor air pollution, to fight indoor air pollution for many years now. The scientific evidence is there, is overwhelming, so it's very much welcome any type of interventions that we can now put in place to increase access to cleaner fuels for cooking. And these people are still relying on solid fuels like, in the Stone Age. Half of the world population is still cooking like the Stone Age. So it's not the Stone Age? Yes, correct? Yeah. So it is absolutely unacceptable. So I think that maybe a small group of people might argue about that, and we need to be prepared to answer to those type of questions. But the public health approach is extremely clear and has been perfectly scientifically demonstrated the benefit of those interventions. Thank you. But I agree with you.
I think we have a question in the back, and then we'll take one here in the front. Maybe we can take a couple together.
Hi, Maria. Dan Carucci with the United Nations Foundation. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about WHO's strategy in the area of awareness raising. It seems that you know, if you think about what the general public thinks about climate change, they think about the environmental effects. And with the renewed interest in health effects, which is probably going to be a much more near-term issue for people, we have an opportunity not only to convince the public health sector that they have to take into account the issues of climate change, but also the general public and our policymakers, to the extent that we can make them more aware of these near-term effects and to perhaps reshape the impact that climate change will have on not only on our planet but on human health. And I'm wondering what WHO's strategy is and how you're thinking about engaging in a more public awareness campaign around the health impacts and climate, and perhaps how some of us here could help.
Should we take it?
Yes. There was another question in the front. I believe, yes, please.
Jean-Paul Chrétien with the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. Thank you for that really nice presentation. I'd like to ask you about the evidence linking climate or climate change in health, and in particular where you see the greatest need for additional evidence of that link in order to move policy in a productive direction.
Mm-hmm. Is there one more that we can take right now, or shall we ask Dr. Neira to address these two and then Jim?
Yes, you'd mentioned partnerships within the health sector, and Guto referenced cross-sectoral. I was wondering if you'd comment a little bit about the partnerships that WHO sees in terms of implementing the work plan that you mentioned.
Okay, let me start by this one, maybe, on partnerships. One of the main themes of the work plan is about partnerships. Which type of partnerships? Obviously, our main partners are ministers of health at the country level, so those will be our main partners, ministers of health, member states with whom we are working every day. Those will be the main focus. But obviously, we have to use on partnership as well those that already exist under the UNFCCC framework, so we are working with them as well. We will, under the partnerships, we need to work with the Nairobi program of work, with our colleagues at the UNDP, with other UN agencies like UNDP and UNEP, and the World Meteorological Organization, and UNICEF, I mean, the UN family. The collaborating centers, as you know, WHO has a very extensive network of collaborating centers. Some of them are not official collaborating centers, but we are engaging in very strong collaboration with different schools of public health or institutions, research groups. And in this sense, we have already a big network of for the agenda of research on climate change and health, and this is addressing maybe a little bit your question on which evidence are still needed. And we had a meeting recently where we defined with the global community of researchers around the world what are the priorities in terms of research, global research for climate change and health, and what are the most important issues that needs to be addressed. So this report will be published next month, so I will be pleased to send you a copy of that, and hopefully to be implemented immediately. We are already commissioning different parts of this global research agenda to different groups, and obviously still looking for more groups that will be interested to join us on that one. So in terms of partnership, institutions, scientific academia, public health schools, partners that will help us to raise awareness, and I welcome the question by the UN Foundation, because this will be a big part of our work, how to raise awareness. We need to raise awareness about the fact that climate change will affect human health. You know, it might be obvious for us or for many people around, you know, working on climate change, but this is still not very well known, particularly by the general public. I don't think they make the linkage between climate change and health. So we still need to do a lot of effort on making sure that first people understand the linkages between climate change and health. And it took us a long effort to even convince our own constituency, the health sector. It took us some, you know, WHO started to work on putting together scientific evidence about the linkage between climate change and health, I think, 20 years ago, correct? The first report produced by WHO on the linkages between whether, I mean, climate and health was produced 20 years ago. So it took a long while to convince the health sector that this was something that we needed to be engaged as well. So on raising awareness, we need to raise awareness among the politicians, policymakers, the health sector, then the general population, and for that we are trying to look at very simple messages where the population will understand that when they take action to reduce climate change or to fight the causes of climate change, they might generate some health co-benefits that are immediate for them. And I think this is a language that we need to work very well on it for passing to the general population and for them to understand this linkage. Now during the World Health Assembly, we will have a first movement on raising awareness and putting together a campaign, but the next months will be very critical. So your help as UN Foundation will be very welcome on this exercise. And I say on in terms of raising awareness, we are engaging the health sector as well, and we want the health sector to be the one leading by example. So if we are able to create this movement by the health community, this can be very, very powerful. But it will be a big effort, and we are just at the beginning. So your ideas, contribution, and engagement and support to our agenda will be really very, very much welcome. I think I addressed the three ones. Thank you.
Are there additional questions? Karen.
Yes. Hi. Thank you so much. This is a quick question. Could you highlight, or where do you see kind of emerging leadership on this? Whether I'm particularly interested in kind of Brazil, India, China, some of the bigger powers moving forward. So.
Very good question, because, as I say, it was very interesting during the World Health Assembly to see the reaction of the ministers of health. Mm-hmm. And it was an amazing support by all countries, you know, from China to Brazil. Obviously, Brazil was very much committed to India, small islands, the group of small islands, because they are very vulnerable. They are particularly showing a leadership now. But there is a leadership that needs to come from all countries, from the smallest one, because they are concerned, in Africa particularly, they are concerned about the consequences that they will be suffering from climate change and the fact that they need to be prepared to face those consequences, and they are not receiving an increased financial support to do that. So they are creating some leadership. We are welcoming now the leadership of the United States, that we were missing a little bit until now. So we are welcoming that now very much. And we are convinced that the five emerging countries, China, Brazil, Russian Federation, South Africa, and India, they have an amazing role to play here. So if we can ensure that they will play a leadership and say, well, a third way is possible. We are, our economies are emerging, and we need to develop our economy, but not by destroying completely our environment, and we want to learn from other countries' experiences and making sure that a good environmental policy is still can be maintained and not spoiling completely their environment, that will not be sustainable for them. So if this model for those five emerging countries can be identified, they can play an amazing leadership on that. I think Brazil is one of those that is very much committed on playing that role.
Yes, Dana.
Hi, I'm Dana Willis from the Department of State. Thanks for your presentation. I had a question about how do you plan to implement the plan organizationally? Will the World Health Organization create an Office of Climate and Health? And I'm also wondering about how much you've budgeted for these activities and if you see that increasing. Thank you.
Well, as you know, WHO is one of the richest organizations in the world, so certainly not doing any fundraising exercise at all. So if you are planning to give us funds, please forget about it. Don't take notes of that. It's a very good question. The answer is we have already a group working on climate change and health. So for us, this is not a new agenda. It's in the department dealing with environmental health, and for us, it's the same agenda. I think it will be a mistake to create something separate from that agenda because it's perfectly under that. We are tackling the environmental determinants of health, and climate change is certainly one of the most important determinants of environmental determinants of health. So we have already that group. It's based in Geneva, but in Washington, but it's based as well in Manila, and it's based in New Delhi, and it's based in Brazzaville. So we have a huge network of the six regional offices in Geneva, well-coordinated under what we call Strategic Objective 8, which is among the 13 strategic objectives of our organization, the WHO organization. We have one, which is number 8, which is dedicated to address the environmental determinants of health. So Strategic Objective 8 is your answer. Regarding the funds we are going to use, we are receiving some financial support from some countries, at the moment particularly Europeans, that are helping us to, you know, initiate our massive work plan, but certainly we are looking for more injection of financial resources, particularly to support vulnerable countries on their adaptation capacities. So through partnership and therefore no financial resources, or through financial resources and therefore working with our countries, we will move on a massive way on this agenda. So if you have ideas for fundraising, let me know.
I just wanted to build on that question and the one about partnerships a little bit earlier. When you discussed partnerships, you referred to academic organizations, you know, the very clear work with the ministries of health in the various countries. But, you know, I wondered what the role of the private sector in some of this is. I know there's been a lot of discussion on the mitigation side, you know, what the private sector can do. But in terms of the health issues and the adaptation side, where do you see the private sector playing a role?
This is a wonderful question. I mean, it's clear that if you want to deal with environmental health issues, we need to work with other sectors. I mean, all the decisions that will affect the health of the people are taken by sectors other than the health sector. And particularly for this agenda on climate change, there will be decisions taken by the energy sector, the transport sector, the majors will be taking decisions related to which type of energy we will be using will affect our health. So all of those decisions will be taken by sectors other than the health sector. So we need to work with them, and we need to work with the private sector. The World Health Organization has a policy to say that we need to, our agenda is so big that we need to engage with the private sector. Now, it's clear that we can engage with the private sector, particularly trying to influence or to present data that will, you know, provide the tool for healthy decisions on their own sectors. And we can engage with the private sector in certain initiatives. In respect to the fundraising, as you know, WHO is very, very cautious on the money we receive from the private sector, and we have a group looking at that very carefully, and we have a lot of limitations. But in terms of partnership, on associating, on exchanging agendas, on influencing agendas on the positive way, is more than welcome, and we have to do it, no way. It will be, we discuss very often with CEOs from major major companies. We do it in under the framework of occupational health because we have the responsibility for occupational health. So we discuss with those CEOs and we discuss with development banks and the way that we try to put some health conditionalities on their lending. So we have dialogue with the private sector. It's true as well that we have a lot of limitations to receive funds or to engage on very direct project with them without passing a very rigorous legal filter. Thank you. But welcome very much partnership with the private sector, definitely.
Thank you. Yes, over here, please. Please say your name and identify yourself.
My name is Giancarlo Galvez from the Mission of Peru to the OAS. First, I must apologize for my English. I will try to do my best. But you mentioned that it's important to raise awareness about climate change. And in this line of ideas, communication is a critical issue. It's important to communicate the effects of the climate change and also to communicate the practical solutions that people can perform to help the environment and to fight climate change. But in that regard, I want to ask, what is the relation between WHO and the media? I mean, to communicate these practical solutions or to create awareness about the climate change. And also, I want to know if you're planning to prepare some kind of online programs or courses or I don't know what how to say that, because I think it's important. It's an important tool to raise awareness once again. Many organizations use these online courses to help to create awareness and also to show what can you do. I mean, it's a very useful tool in this era of the internet. So, are you planning to work on that? Thank you.
Sí, muchas gracias por la pregunta. Thank you. Yes, media. We would love to be on the media every day, but, although I think we have very exciting news. They are giving us the space they want to give us. The WHO agenda is huge. Therefore, passing messages to the media is always a challenge. But, yes, we want to launch a media campaign, a big communication campaign, trying to make sure that the we raise awareness and we use the media. We are trying as well to create a group of media-related experts and passing them regularly information for further dissemination. And, the WHO channels for being in contact with the media are very powerful. Maybe you want to say more about that. But, yes, definitely we will use the media and the communication to raise awareness. Online training courses, or we have our website that you can visit. There is a lot of material that is already there. But the idea of training courses online is something that we are as well exploring and probably very soon will be available. And I think in one of our regions already exists. I think in Seattle. Yeah.
Can I add something to that? Just an instructive tale about WHO's power. The EPA, USEPA, and the Partnership for Clean Indoor Air and Shell Foundation a couple of years ago held a press conference in New Delhi on the health effects of indoor air pollution. And WHO was to attend, and Shell Foundation, EPA, Terry was going to be there, a couple other of academic speakers. And at the last minute, the WHO attendee could not make it. So one of the other attendees gave the health presentation. We got a tremendous amount of press, about 10, I think, distinct articles in about 100 newspapers around the world the next day. In every single article, the front quote was from the WHO person who could not make it. So it's a brand and it's a prestige and a respect that you have that's tremendously powerful. And so I encourage you to take advantage of that as much as possible.
Yes, I'm James Hill. I'm with the External Relations Resource Mobilization Partnerships and Pan-American Health Organization, which is also the regional office of WHO. You were commenting about relations with the private sector. I've been with PAHO for 10 years. I'm very aware of conflict of interest issues. But I just wanted to highlight that WHO and PAHO has made some progress, especially with chronic non-communicable diseases. And WHO has been engaging the private sector through the World Economic Forum. And just recently, there was a regional meeting of the World Economic Forum in Brazil. So this might be, I think that there is a linkage between climate change and chronic diseases. I mean, especially when you think of some of the breathing problems. So that might be, I wouldn't want to discourage private sector relations. I think that the approach would be to avoid bilateral type relationships and go more for a consortium type approach and invite all the private sector, be it transport, be it recreation, to work together. And that way you avoid the issue of competitive advantage. I think that's always the issue of WHO engaging the private sector. Are we giving competitive advantage to a particular company? But if we can engage the private sector on more of an industrial sort of a sector approach and invite all the companies to work on this work plan, I think that is an approach that could work and I think does have promise.
With our colleagues on non-communicable diseases, we are already using their network and with the private sector to convince them that there is a joint agenda. I don't know whether you saw today on the press, there is something that has been, a book that has been presented, which is called Globicity, so Global Obesity. It's very interesting because it's linking the non-communicable diseases agenda with climate change. So here we are. Yes. Our Director General, Dr. Margaret Chan, she used to say that with exception, very strong exception of tobacco companies, which we don't want to even hear about it, WHO is supposed to work with everyone in the private sector, with exception of tobacco companies. So, yes.
All right. Well, thank you very much for attending this session on this very rainy morning. Speaking of climate, even though it's Earth Day today, it's supposed to be sunny and nice outside. Please join me in thanking Dr. Neda for spending part of her short week here. And we'll break now, and I hope perhaps you'll have a few minutes to talk one-on-one. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Thank you.